Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, part two of our discussion about politics, identity, and stereotypes. At 9, we talked about the most destructive stereotypes that are lobbed at Republican voters. And they'll sound familiar, racist, sexist, haters, and why using those one-dimensional labels is contributing to our extreme polarization in the country. This hour, we're doing the same with Democrats, those lefty, God-hating, never-met-a-government-program-they-didn't-love stereotypes that the other side indulges in. Now, as I said at 9, this is a show for deeper thinking, for some serious reflection, both in the calls and on social media today. As we start, I'd like you to acknowledge this, that humans and voters are complex and multidimensional no matter who they voted for in 2016, and labels are simplistic and one-dimensional. So if we're going to make these discussions meaningful, I need you to do some of your best thinking, and I'd love to hear it via social media and on the phone lines. If you're a Democratic voter, are those labels about you hurtful and damaging? What is misunderstood about who you are as a Democratic voter? And Republicans, do you really think they sum up most Democratic voters? So Democrats, I want to hear from you on the labels and what this feels like and what your answer back to some of these labels would be. And then Republicans, just as we did at 9, Republicans, do you really think, honestly, that those labels sum up Democratic voters? Again, no matter who they voted for. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Our guest this hour, Liz Mayer, is a Republican strategist and president of Mayer Strategies, and she's with us today from Chicago. Liz, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Shana Gadarian is with us. She's an associate professor of political science at Syracuse University, and she's with us from Syracuse, New York. Shana, welcome. Really good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Liz, Americans are undoubtedly worried about how politically polarized we are. As I started at nine, I'd like to hear you on why these stereotypes and these labels have such currency in our political discussion. Why do we use them?
Well, I mean, I think in some cases we use them because there's a degree of accuracy in them, right? Now, that's not true with every label that we apply and every description, but there is sort of a kernel of truth in quite a few of them, and so that's kind of where they emanate from. But in addition, you know, I can't speak to the sort of sociological rationale for this, but it does appear to me that in my lifetime, politics has become more tribal. And, you know, I think much like sports fans, I mean, it's easy for everybody to sort of characterize all Eagles fans as a gang of thugs, right? I mean, the same way that we would characterize Eagles fans as a gang of thugs, and Eagles fans, I'm sure, would characterize Patriots fans as something else, whatever. You know, it's kind of just what we get into psychologically as human beings. I think there's a little bit of the sort of ape that's left in us, and this is one of the ways that it exhibits itself. But sometimes there is a measure of truth in some of these criticisms and some of these labels.
You know, Shana, to hear what Liz is saying here, I think puts its finger on it, which is this sense of belonging. I will belong more closely to my tribe if I can call your tribe or label your tribe that. And that is how we will each define ourselves, but I will have a deeper sense of belonging. Is there something to that?
Sure. I think there's a long line of research that suggests that in-groups are very meaningful for people, and we derive identity and we derive comfort from knowing which groups we belong to. But I think this kind of elides over the fact that there's a lot of work that needs to be done to define which groups we belong to. We all have lots of identities. And it's not always the case that we have to set our group up against another group.
Right.
And that is what seems to be changing over the last decade or so, is this kind of polarization between in the mass public between what it means to be a Democrat and what it means to be a Republican, that it's no longer just kind of comfort with one's own group. It's that the other group is terrible. And there's work by Shanto Iyengar and Sean Westwood that suggests that people now think about the other party and think about they don't want their children marrying across party lines,
right,
in ways that have changed over time. And I do think there is some psychology to this. Again, in-groups are very powerful. But again, I think we want to be clear that there's a lot of work that elites need to do and the parties need to do and the media do in order to actually drive the parties apart.
This is one of the things that we came to at 9, Liz, which is the parties and the candidates are not invested in less polarization. The media is definitely not invested in less polarization because it creates more conflict, and conflict is interesting. Mm-hmm. I think we agreed at 9 that voters are going to have to do this themselves. How willing do you think voters are to do this?
Well, I don't know. You know, I think that one other thought that occurs to me is that I think as we've had the erosion of some other community structures in our country, I think people have turned to politics as a way of identifying and finding a community, right? And so I don't know, given that, how willing voters are going to be to do it themselves. I certainly agree with the characterization that the media has a lot invested in polarization and in causing fights. I mean, you know, you turn on any cable news channel and basically
exactly.
The entertainment is a Democrat and a Republican going at each other, you know, going at each other's throats. With regard to the parties, though, and with regard to candidates, that does vary a little bit cycle by cycle. I think there's a tendency to think that, you know, it's always the most extreme people who end up facing off against each other, or there's this constant drive to go to the extremes. I'm not sure that's actually true in every race. If we go back and we look at 2008, for example, when I was working at the Republican National Committee, I mean, the reality is that both parties probably nominated the more moderate and palatable candidate that they had a choice of, right? I mean, certainly there were people who were positioning themselves well to the right of John McCain. And I think that, frankly, a lot of Hillary Clinton's record, you know, while she sort of tried to cultivate this thing of being a centrist and having represented upstate New York, not just all of the sort of liberal elites in Manhattan, you know, her record actually was, in many respects, far to the left of Barack Obama's. And so, you know, I do think it's worth bearing that in mind, that that's possibly a narrative that's not 100% accurate historically. But certainly I agree with you with regard to the media. I mean, you know, they know that conflict drives viewership and viewership drives ad revenue. So that's what they're looking for a lot of the time.
And let me just add this, too, before we go to calls. And I want to hear from a lot of voters here that I don't mean in every cycle and every individual election, but I also do mean in the way the candidates will speak to different groups. I think that also, depending what audience they're in front of, I think that also reinforces this idea that they're often speaking to their base with one kind of language and they're activating those activists. And that reinforces this idea that it's us and them.
I think sometimes that's true, but again, as a strategist, I have to push back on that a little bit, because we do see a lot of that. But oftentimes the candidates and the campaigns that are using different messages and different rhetoric and different sort of tone with different audiences, those are the ones that oftentimes find themselves in trouble because they come off as being inauthentic and looking like they're flip-flopping. I think that, you know, where you have more of a point is if you're looking at, you know, sort of the resistance now facing off versus like the Trumpite faction. you know, clearly neither of those constituencies are varying their language at all, regardless of who they're talking to. That's just what they think, and what they think happens to be fairly on the extremes of the political debate in America. But, you know, I think going back, you know, you look at, again, going back to 2008, I mean, Barack Obama wasn't really varying what he was saying to audiences, depending on who he was talking to. Hillary Clinton was. John McCain didn't really vary what he was saying to audiences, depending on who he was talking to. Mitt Romney did. Now, obviously, Hillary Clinton was trying to get more traction with the left and sort of edge Obama out there. And clearly, Mitt Romney was trying to edge McCain out on the right, and it didn't work. I mean, Hillary Clinton came off as looking completely inauthentic and implausible, which is a problem that has dogged her right up through the 2016 election and probably was, you know, a core reason why she lost then as well as in 2008.
All right.
And as far as Mitt Romney's concerned, you know, I mean, his reputation is one as being the chief flip-flopper that we've seen any time recently in American politics. So it hasn't really helped him.
Let me say this, that I led us into this discussion about candidates, and I don't want this hour to be about candidates because I don't think that's where reducing the polarization is here. So let me grab some calls to Jacob in Schaefer. Hey, Jacob, thanks so much for waiting. How are you? What are you thinking about this? Are you a Democrat?
I'm a liberal, and the topic I want to discuss is I've noticed that conservatives have taken ownership over patriotism. And I consider myself a liberal. I'm an Eagle Scout. I served my community through the AmeriCorps program out of college. And I find that trend kind of offensive. I mean, it's gotten to the point where I feel like if I fly an American flag outside of my home, I'm considered a conservative by my neighbors.
This is a really good point, Shana. And I think we will hear other Democrats say that they feel crowded out of this sense of being able to display a pride in their country. How'd that happen?
Sure. I think this is a really good and interesting example of a kind of broader phenomenon, which political scientists call issue ownership. This is the idea that the parties, because of their constituencies and what the kind of policies that they focus on, are better on some issues than others.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you don't agree with that party, you might see them as kind of the party of, say, national security. And the Republican Party for a long time has been the party of defense and national security. And these things get tied up with patriotism. And one of the things, so issue ownership is kind of sticky over time. That is, unless something changes and the party looks like it's not performing well on an issue, it tends to kind of keep that advantage. And so when we're talking about patriotism, we're talking about national security, that tends to benefit the Republican Party. And there are issues that the Democrats own, too. But one of the things that I think is so interesting about this upcoming cycle is that I do think this is changing a little bit in terms of patriotism and foreign policy. And partially it's because there's a new generation of Democratic veterans who are now running for office under this banner of patriotism comes in many forms. And I think this is a thing that might be changing over time. I do think it's a longer term trend and we'll have to see. But I think there's such interesting this is such an interesting trend to me to see whether or not this issue ownership on foreign policy changes because of the new people who are going to be in office, you know, going forward.
A call here from David in Minnetonka. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi. Are you a Democrat?
Yeah, I'm a left-leaning Democrat.
Okay.
And I guess there's two things. One is I find the anger among the Republican political leadership and elected officials to be very off-putting. But everything I read in the paper, everything I hear on the radio is about we're doing this because we're angry. And it makes it hard to communicate with them. It makes it hard to communicate with my Republican friends when we want to just have a heartfelt conversation. And those of whom I can have conversations, you know, we just recognize we have differences. You know, I mean, what's the fundamental difference? I would suppose in my case is I believe that the government has a place in making our society better, in helping people, where I would say that while my right-leaning friends would acknowledge that that's important, they would place a primacy on reducing the budget rather than spending resources on that.
You actually sound like, David, you're in a place where you could have a meaningful and receptive, you know, a truly listening and engaged conversation with someone who holds different views. But I will say this, and Shana, give me your thoughts on this. I don't think the anger, the perception of the anger, only flows one way. I think Republicans see the demonstrations right and from the left and say there's a lot of anger there too. That's part of what's making, what's deepening the polarization.
Sure. So I study the role of emotion in politics. Uh-huh. And one of the major emotions that I see in this last year and a half has been anger. And Stephen Webster and Alan Abramowitz at Emory have some really fascinating work looking at anger and its drive to polarizing people on their attitudes and also how they feel about the other party. But you're right that so anger is a motivating emotion. It's about blame and it's about action. And so one of the things that's underlying this resistance to the Trump agenda and the marches and getting people to work together is anger at the way in which the 2016 election came out and the governing that's gone on since then. And I agree that anger is, you know, anger isn't just used by one side. It is certainly undergirding the resistance movements and the marches. And I mean, you even see that on the signs.
Right.
And it's pushing people to. So I actually don't think anger is necessarily a bad thing because it actually gets people to participate in politics, particularly people who were not interested in politics. They are now participating because they are angry. But again, one of the flip sides of that is it might push people past being able to have conversations
right,
with each other.
Right.
And that's where you need some other kinds of emotions like empathy. And so what your caller is talking about is having the ability to perspective take, to say, I see your point, and I kind of value you as a person to have discussions with, and we don't have to agree, but we have to at least, you know, have some empathy for each other in order to have a conversation.
Exactly.
And I do think that empathy and anger can actually co-occur, and we can be angry about politics, but we, as long as we kind of look and see that the other person we're trying to have a conversation with also has values and they also have a perspective, we can have some more, we can have some better conversations.
Derek called from Woodbury to say, if I identify as a Democrat, Republicans in my family think I'm not for gun rights and that I'm pro-choice. When you lump people into categories, it's not accurate. At the root of all the issues, I think we're passionate about a lot of the same things. One of the things we talked about, Liz, at 9 o'clock was, how do you account for the consequences of the policies that you believe in? You know what I'm saying? Like, if you believe in not in limiting legal immigration, that means that there are some people who are not going to get into the United States, and mm-hmm. and maybe they end up in very difficult circumstances in their own country. Those are consequences. And people were calling to say, how do I have a civil, engaged discussion when I have to account for the consequences of my beliefs or their beliefs? Do you have some insight on that?
Well, first of all, let me say that the two points that your listener raised, abortion and gun rights, are by far the most difficult ones for anybody to find any common ground or to do any persuasion. Abortion is slightly less difficult in my experience than gun rights, but you know, I'm a very, very strong supporter of the Second Amendment, and I have yet to ever have had at any point in my 39 years on this planet a productive conversation with somebody who is in favor of gun control where either of us moved on the issue even a little bit.
It isn't about moving on the issue, though, Liz. You really have never had a discussion where you listened with empathy and engaged with empathy and saw the other side?
I think it's very, very tough to do on that and on abortion because they are extremely personal issues where I think, you know, I mean, the abortion issue is easier to explain, right? I mean, if you're pro-life, you see that literally as an issue of life and death. I mean, it's pretty hard to have empathy with if you're having a discussion with somebody that you see as inherently not on the side of life. I mean,
yeah.
that's an obstacle that I don't know how you get over. Now, in my personal experience, I have the extreme discomfort of holding a position that does not clearly qualify as either pro-life or pro-choice.
Uh-huh.
So I get hit with this from all sides. You know, and I guess, you know, I can see sort of some logic and rationale in a couple different positions. But, you know, I'm going to be candid with you. When I talk to somebody who says, I honestly do not believe that a baby is alive until it is physically traveling down the birth canal in the course of labor, I don't know how to have an empathetic conversation with that person because I think that's totally irrational
and insane. But Liz,
no way to get beyond that,
Hold on a second. What you're talking about, though, is coming into a discussion about that where one person or the other has to say, yes, you know, you're right. It isn't about winning the argument, as we said at 9 o'clock. It's about understanding why a person holds the views that they do. Yes, go ahead.
But, well, I'm not sure when we're talking about abortion that's true because, you know, I don't know what your personal view is on abortion, but if you are somebody who is strongly pro-life, people who are strongly pro-life honestly believe that they need to win as many arguments as they can because that's literally how they save lives. That's literally how they view it. And so I think that what we're talking about, I mean, if we're having a discussion about, I don't know what policy we can execute in order to help the homeless, I think you can come into that conversation in the way that you're describing, with the objective being having more civil discussion and empathy and not necessarily persuading somebody or not.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're somebody who's strongly pro-life, no, your view really is if you don't convert every pro-choicer, babies are dying. And that's a real high hurdle. So I think what you're talking about, frankly, doesn't even really apply to the abortion debate and probably never can. And I would say for strong pro-choicers that I know, the same thing is true. You know, there are people that I know, people who are affiliated with Planned Parenthood, who honest to God feel that if we do not have a system that allows a woman to have an abortion in month 9 of pregnancy, then we're basically like chaining women to the kitchen sink and going back to the 18th century. And if that's your viewpoint, I don't know how you have a conversation with anybody with any sort of empathy or even without being the objective. I just don't think that's possible.
Do you want to say something about that?
So I want to back up, I think, to the original question, which was more about whether or not when we stereotype parties that have positions and then we think about the people who were in those parties. So if you're a kind of a pro-life Democrat, and so how do is that fair for us to have these stereotypes that everyone in a party kind of fulfills all of the positions that the whole party takes? And I think that's the difficulty of a two-party system, right? We have these big tent parties and they have positions, and that there are people who certainly don't fit every position in the party, and they might feel uncomfortable on certain issues for sure, and particularly issues like abortion or gun rights, right? If they don't take the position that the party takes. And we have seen kind of members of Congress who have positions that are out of step with the party on these kinds of issues kind of retire, or they're pushed out on very important issues to the party. But I do think this is part of where the kind of stereotypes come in.
Mm-hmm.
And so we think of, you know, these big tent parties having these positions, and then we just apply that position to new people that we meet. And
that's kind of paste it on.
Exactly. And so then the people in the party who don't fit as well need to think about what they want to do about that. And we actually have evidence that people actually will change their opinions on things like abortion based on the parties that they belong to. So people have lots of ways that they can do this. They can think about if their party comes first, they will then adjust positions on other issues, or potentially they might change parties. But that's actually less usual than people adopting new positions based on the party that they belong to. And so, again, this is why, like, actually applying the stereotype of a pro-life Republican and a pro-choice Democrat is usually efficient, but it does leave out these folks who don't fit exactly with the party on all issues.
Shana Guderian with us from Syracuse University and Liz Mayer with us today from Mayer Strategies. To the phones, because we have a number of people that want to talk about this, to Don in Grand Rapids. Hi, Don. Have we gotten past the point you wanted to make, or do you have something to add here?
I think some of my points have already been made, but I am a non-religious conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And as a person who feels that the concept of God was created by cavemen trying to explain lightning to each other.
Don, move on it, here, okay? What did you want to say?
Well, I used to find it very difficult to speak with people about religion, and it seems lately it's a lot easier to speak with people about religion and a lot more difficult to speak with people about politics.
Really?
And it might be because of the lower incidence of religion that those same people are now pouring that same fervor into their politics.
Okay. All right. I appreciate the call to Pat in Minnetonka. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
What are you thinking about?
Well, I have the stereotype that people think because I'm associated with an evangelical Christian church that I must be Republican. And I don't align myself with either major party. I have voted both ways, and I have voted independently. I don't believe in being a pawn for political parties. In fact, I recently went to a conference, an evangelical Christian conference, where it was stressed that that the evangelical Christian church needs to not be used by either party. And they are used many times.
Okay.
Because they are such a big voting block.
But Liz, when you bring religion into this, does that does that make it more difficult to, I guess, dispel some of the stereotypes around this?
Well, I think it's interesting. The comment that your first caller there made, I think, is spot on in some regards. I think people sort of declining religiosity, you know, whether that is actually reflected in church attendance or not, I think has kind of been supplanted or has caused religion to be kind of supplanted by politics. But, you know, certainly when we're talking about religion, yeah, I mean, it's another factor that I think people tend to use to sort of stereotype people. I actually personally think, though, that when we're getting back to your point about having more civil discourse and empathy for other people's positions and being willing to hear each other out and not just immediately judge on spec, actually religion is oftentimes, or I have found it to oftentimes be a useful conduit to getting to that kind of a place.
How so?
Well, I think certainly there is a perception that if you say I'm an evangelical, that probably means you're conservative and it probably means you're a Republican. But I think there's also some work that the Democratic Party did sort of 2006 through 2008 that was actually aimed at sort of establishing a block of, you know, sort of liberal evangelical voters who certainly do exist. And I also think that a lot of what has gone on with Catholic voters has been interesting, and frankly, with Jewish voters has been interesting on that front, too. You know, I think that traditionally people sort of hear I'm Jewish and they think, well, 90% chance that you're liberal. And, you know, I think most Jewish voters are pretty liberal. However, I think as we've seen various changes with regard to Israel policy, you've seen some shifts particularly tied in with that. And so I don't think people necessarily can treat it so much as a given there. And as far as Catholics are concerned, yeah, I feel like depending on what's at stake at any given point, we can go in a number of different directions. So while traditionally I think there's been a perception that Catholics tend to align more Democrat, you know, I find as a Catholic myself now, you know, if people don't know what I do for a living, if they, you know, have no sense of sort of who I am or my identity, if what they know about me is that I'm Catholic, actually, in some regards, that wipes all preconceptions with regard to politics off the map.
Interesting.
Usually where I get in trouble as a Catholic is there's an assumption that I may hold any number of philosophies, but probably not that I'm a libertarian.
Uh-huh.
And when people find out that I'm a libertarian, that can be a little bit mind-blowing for them. They do think libertarianism is not totally in keeping with sort of Catholic tradition, which, you know, you can make that argument too.
That's really interesting. Shana, speak to what Liz was saying about religion. Maybe that is the conduit. Maybe it doesn't contribute to the tribalism as I would have expected.
So one point I want to make is when we talk about evangelicals as a group, we want to be clear that white evangelicals and Latino and African-American evangelicals and Asian-American evangelicals are separate groups in the way in which they vote. And so the assumptions about white evangelicals more likely to be conservative is more aligned with the voting behavior and the attitudes of that group, and that evangelicals of color are more likely, right? So again, these are averages, not necessarily stereotypes, are more likely to identify and vote as Democrats. So this is an interesting point about whether or not we can use religious belief and religiosity as ways to be empathetic,
right?
And talk across lines of difference. And I do think this is an interesting idea. Rob Willer, who's a sociologist at Stanford, has work thinking about using the language of the other side in talking across lines of difference. And some of the work that he's talking about is values that people have in terms of compassion and, you know, caring for others. And there's lots of these values that one side kind of holds as more important than others. And I do think these kind of overlay with religiosity pretty well. And so if you can learn the language that the other side uses, right, this is not about being fake, right? It's about thinking about the perspective of the people that you're talking to and thinking about what is important to them and kind of speaking their language. I think that does help in how we can have discussions. And again, you know, as a political scientist, like, we know persuasion is really hard, and that doesn't always have to be the goal.
Right.
The goal can actually be, let's talk about politics and the things both that we agree upon and then think about how we might come to some at least understanding of the other side, even if we're not persuading people.
So, Liz, I have to let you go in just a couple of minutes, but I wanted to say one more thing. I think about some of this is about bringing your highest quality. And when I say argument, I don't really mean that in the battling sense. Your highest quality argument to a discussion about not shorthanding it, not taking it off of social media, really thinking it through, as Shana was going to say. And I know social media is not the place for that. Do you think it would be different if we practice that more often? Or am I just naive in thinking, you know, this is a moment for that? You know what I'm asking?
I certainly think it's worth people trying harder at. I would push back a little bit with regard to social media because, yes, I mean, you know, I spend a good amount of my time on Twitter, and people can get really vitriolic really fast with each other there.
As they've been doing this morning, by the way, Liz. Yes.
As I'm sure they have. But I will also say that in my experience, there are several liberal friends that I have who, you know, I converse back and forth with on Twitter, who I actually find that I have some of the most productive and polite and civil and in-depth and meaningful conversations with. And so I totally think that's possible. Like I say, I think there are a couple of issues where good luck with that. Like if you're talking about abortion and guns, I just don't really think that's much going to happen. But with regard to a whole range of other issues, I think that it's possible. And when you're talking about, you know, which candidate do you prefer and why, I also think it's totally possible. But yes, I mean, obviously, I do think that it entails people putting themselves in a frame of mind where when they enter into a discussion, they're really remembering the first thing that's most important is the friendship.
Right.
After that is the winning the political argument. And I think sometimes people can get those two things reversed in their minds, and that's where we start having problems.
But again, you said winning the political argument. I don't think that has to be the goal in these kinds of productive discussions. It sounds like you disagree with that.
I mean, I don't know that it necessarily has to be the goal. I just think for most people who are going to engage in political discussions, it ends up being the goal. I just think that's kind of default human behavior. You know, we always want to be right about things. That's what we do. And we like to win. Nobody likes to have the sense that they lost or it was a draw. I mean, again, going back to sports, you know, there's a reason that people, you know, I don't know. I'm a big follower of Premiership football in England. I don't know how many of your listeners are, but there's a big reason that Manchester United fans right now are pissed off under Jose Mourinho when they weren't under Sir Alex Ferguson. And it's because they liked winning like 3-0, 4-0, whatever, with a couple goals in the last 5 minutes under Sir Alex Ferguson. Under Jose Mourinho, they actually have a pretty good record and they're performing pretty well against teams that should be really besting them a lot. But, you know, they're winning like 1-0. And I think there are a lot of people who in that same mindset, they'd rather have a bunch of 4-0 wins, even if they end up like third or fourth in the table, than they would have a bunch of 1-0 wins and be sitting in second
place.
Okay,
I have to take your word for all of this. But
yes, Liz, you take my word for all of this. I feel that I've won this argument.
You definitely have.
Obviously.
You have. Liz, thank you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. Liz Mayer
is a Republican strategist and president of Mayer Strategies. Let me grab a call here from Christina in St. Paul. Hi, Christina. What's your experience with this bringing to the discussion?
I would have to disagree with your Republican strategist, but I was formerly a Democrat and a Republican. Now I'm a Green.
Okay.
And yeah. And so I go into conversations with my friends, colleagues, other fellow party members about understanding why they believe what they believe.
Oh,
it's not
good.
About winning
yep.
the argument, because I don't think politics should be about winning and losing, because politics is about people. And we're not that black and white. And people have complex feelings about things. And I'm also an RN, mm-hmm. and I try to use my therapeutic background and just bring mm-hmm. out those things, but also just understand, okay, you're pro-life. Why do you feel that way?
Right.
You're pro-choice. Why do you feel that way? I think we both can agree we don't want babies killed, right? So let's figure out how we can get there. You know, like, that's what I talk to people about. You know,
so Shana, I think Christina is really bringing, when Liz was saying earlier that abortion is one of those just impossible discussions to bring empathy and understanding to if you're on opposite sides, I actually think Christina just demonstrated how you do that. And why you should do that.
Sure. I mean, so one thing to keep in mind is most people don't talk about politics most of the time, right? I think your listeners I know. Like, the people that I hang out with, my students, and your listeners are kind of an unusual subset of people who talk about politics. So while I do think polarization is really important and we should really keep talking about them. The stereotypes are most useful because most people don't pay attention to politics and don't have these conversations. And I actually do think that having conversations where people learn about positions on politics, and, you know, some issues are easier than others to understand, right? Abortion, other kind of rights issues might be easier because people have more facility with those experiences. They're easier to understand, but things like foreign policy, these are much more technical and harder to understand. So I do think, yes, it sounds like that's the way to bring empathy into a conversation about abortion. But I do think it's worth mentioning how most people don't think about politics most of the time. And so to the extent that they have these stereotypes in their heads, they use them because they're easy. And because politics is complicated and isn't interesting for everyone, which I find you know, sad, of course, because this is why I study for a living.
Yeah.
But that stereotypes are there and useful for the most part because people don't think about these things all the time. And so when they do, I do think that bringing empathy across lines of difference is really important in the way that your caller just described. But that's not always what's happening because most of the people, again, most people are tuned out most of the time for very good reasons, right? Like they have lives, they have to go to work, they, you know, they don't find politics interesting.
Well, I mean, they might not discuss it the way you do, but think about what happens on Facebook every day. I mean, there is political discussion going on. I don't know what kind of level of quality it is, but I think we're slipping into that a lot during the day.
So I think that social media is a place where people don't necessarily go to look for politics, but it is there. And that's right. And there is politics out there in the world. Whether or not people actually engage with it is a different issue. And I don't mean engage like high level thinking where they can take a test about it. I mean like that they actually read the articles or they have a kind of back and forth about it. And we know for the most part, based on survey data and other things, that you know, election times are a little bit different because there's a lots more political discussion. But I agree that social media is one of the places where people don't have to actively look for politics, but it's there. But we don't know how much people are actually taking in that information.
Exactly.
And talking to others about it.
Yeah. Let me grab a call here from Philip in St. Paul. Hey, Philip, I know it's been a while. Thanks so much for waiting. Tell me what you're thinking about.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So to go back to the issue of stereotypes, I consider myself liberal left of center. I've voted Democratic in every election since I've been able to vote.
Uh-huh.
I've got some seemingly contradictory positions. You know, I'm a gun owner. I'm an Orthodox Christian, so I catch heat from people on my own side. But I'm also a veteran. And one stereotype that really drives me crazy is the assumption from people on the right that if you are a Democrat or a liberal, you are a pacifist or a hippie, I guess would be the less nice term. But, you know, having been in the military, I recognize that we need to have a strong national defense and the ability to respond to real threats militarily when need be.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, the historic record sort of shows that President Obama was far more aggressive at, you know, conducting the war on terror than his predecessor was.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're saying you yourself also don't fit neatly into some stereotype box that says, well, if you served, you vote Republican, and these are all the other labels that I can apply to you.
Yeah, exactly. Or that if you served and you vote Democratic, it's because you have this animus towards the military or something
right.
like that. That's
right.
That's not the case.
Really glad for your call, Philip. Thank you. And I want to see if I can get Carol in Blaine in. Carol, I'm a little limited on time here, but I'd like to hear about your family experience with this.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
I'm listening this morning, and you were talking about empathy.
Yeah.
My son is a staunch Trump supporter, and I am liberal on my views. My husband is a retired police officer. So one hot issue in our family is gun control. My husband and I believe there needs to be more gun control, and my son, of course, not at all.
Uh-huh.
But we've had discussions about this issue, and because we have respect for each other's opinion, we've never had an argument. And as we've discussed and asked back and forth, we have always managed to come up with some common ground because, you know, maybe his defenses are lessened because, you know, the respect we have for each other.
Right, because it's his mother asking, right?
I'm open to what he has to say because he knows that. I want to understand where he's coming from.
Shayna, Carol, thanks. Shayna, I think this is meaningful to practice in your family and really difficult.
I think that's right. And many of us live in families where there isn't disagreement within the kind of the kind of parents, children. But obviously that's not the case for everyone. And so having these discussions, I do think starting off from the position of these are people I care about, and this is not an interact. So the thing about social media is that arguments can get out of control relatively quickly because these might be people you don't know and you may never see.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can insult them and you're never going to have to see them and you can feel okay about that. But when you're talking about a family unit and you have to agree and live together into the future, right, that does tend to tamp down on the kind of the vitriol that you see in other kinds of conversations. And I do think that's really meaningful and maybe a model for how we can have these conversations outside family units.
Yeah.
One thing I do want to note, though, is that there's a really interesting thing that's maybe the reverse of this caller's family that I think is going to go on in the next couple of years on the issue of gun control, is that I do think that kids' views on gun control are going to start influencing parents,
right,
in ways that we generally think that parents influence kids on policy attitudes. But I do think that there's going to be this interesting shift if we see this gun control movement that's being headed by high school students. I think if that goes into the future, we're going to see this very interesting kind of reverse socialization on issues around gun control.
That sounds like a really good topic for another show.
Sure.
Yeah, Shayna, thank you so much. Really good to have
your
insight in the discussion. Shayna Gadarian from Syracuse University, where she's an associate professor of political science. By the way, if you missed the 9 o'clock hour on this was a two-part discussion. You can find it on my podcast.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.